you know, because of the time. The last thing, Dave, why don't you tell us about some of your experiences of our policy about drug addiction within U.S. military personnel, military personnel problems with drug addiction or drug abuse.
Well, this is a subject that, you know, we started on and we went into somewhat extensively on Sunday when we were talking about what we do to ourselves. And I think it's just worth repeating the fact that if you went there, as I went there, a fully trained psychiatrist, and that makes me have enough brains in my head, supposedly, to come up with a standing diagnosis for any one individual. And our policy and the regulations which I worked under precluded my being able to send people out of country for further treatment that I could make a positive diagnosis of severe physical addiction to a drug such as heroin or opium. In this country, we consider this a big enough disorder that we hospitalize people for this and we take them away from the source of the drug. There was no way to take people away from the source of the drug in Vietnam, and that doesn't come as any new bit of information to anybody, any of the vets that were here. You get drugs anywhere. There's no problem where that was concerned. I dislike to use the word, but I can't really think of another one. I was monitored where this was concerned. It took 2 days for my Medivac write-ups to for the Medivac-E to get on the plane and get the hell out of country. He went to Tansanut the next day and he rested there for a day, and then he got on the plane and went the following day. So this left plenty of time for my write-ups to go up Long Bend to the office of the psychiatric consultant from the Surgeon General's office for Vietnam. And if I try to push something through like this, I would get a phone call and I would be told that this was simply not... Am I coming through? This was simply not policy. And that I could not, what the hell was I doing trying to medevac this person out of country? The one person that stands out largest in my memory was a black kid who came in on 6 different occasions, had shot up to 30 cc's of heroin or opium a day, 4 cc's at a crack 7-8 times a day. If this is not addiction, I don't know what it is. And he would be taken by the MPs back to some MP unit and then be released to his company commander again, because it was such a rampant problem, they didn't have space for these people, and so they didn't know what the hell to do with them, so they ended up giving them back to the company commander. And the company commander may or may not have been an understanding guy. He'd try to put the man back to work, and of course this man would be back in the hospital again. I harbored a few of these people for a while. Most of my patients were on Ward 8, and I would sneak these people up to Ward 9, which was a convalescent ward. And again, I constantly got bombarded from the hospital itself because regulations there said I couldn't keep anybody for more than 30 days. And I got called down front many times and accused of harboring individuals, and I confessed to it. But these were the people who had been in so many times that, you know, it was like clockwork, 3 days or 4 days from the time I let them out, they'd be back. And I kept trying to tell people this, and I kept getting turned off. Nobody ever offered me an explanation as to what I should have done with these folks, except wean them off the drug at that particular time and don't worry about their addiction. And their ETS, or their DROS day, their day for leaving, would rotate around sometime, and I'd be rid of that problem, and I'd just have another one to handle. And this is about the way it went for me all year long.
Didn't have any methadone?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that on Sunday. And again, it's worth mentioning again, I suppose. I was denied methadone. I don't know why the hell I was denied methadone, but I broke people on Thorazine. And I might say, you know, it served the purpose, and most people adequately came down. But that doesn't take away the addiction, and it's not the drug of choice. Anybody who has any Medical school training knows that. That's a simple proposition. And I think that one of the things that was put forth was that it was too expensive, and you know that's a crock of shit. It's a cent and a half a tablet.
In terms of hard drug use, that's heavy use of barbiturates, heroin, speed. How many of these guys started over there? Any idea?
Well, I don't have figures because I never kept figures. I would have made a tremendous study, I suppose, for somebody's article. But I felt so sick inside most of the time, I wasn't really concerned with articles. I'd say that probably one out of two or two out of five or three out of five of the people who would come in would outrightly confess to me that they had taken nothing. Maybe they'd smoked some pot while they were in this country, but that was about the extent of it. And I don't know what their purpose would have been in lying. I really don't know.
Yeah, just about any kind of drug that you can think of, from heroin on down, if you couldn't get it from one of the guys in the hospital, it could be bought downtown. And
it was no problem to get drugs up onto the ward even. While I'm at it, there's another thing I'd like to get my licks in on, and I've forgotten about it until right now. When I came in the country, I was shown my office. The office was in the back of an area which had been the day room, and that would have been okay. The day room had some things we could have used almost for therapy. At that time, it had pool tables and ping pong tables, this kind of thing, card tables. This place had been turned into a special services library and had been carpeted much the same as the carpeting on this floor, and rows of books had been put up, and most of the time, the damn thing just went to no avail. It was a good showpiece for people who came in to see Third Field and Nurses in Whites, et cetera, et cetera. But the psychiatric office, and I made this clear to people that I was talking to Sunday night, that office and I had a real fancy name, Chief of Department of Psychiatry and Neurology. That was fine, except there was no other psychiatrist and there was no neurologist. So I was it, and I had a social worker and two techs. And then I had to fight like hell when they went home to get some more techs to replace them. The type of degradation that I felt that this particular service of medicine was held in, here I sat with my office in the back of a special services library. This wasn't bad enough. We continued under this. But my inpatient service was on an open medical ward, and I'd just like to describe the ward briefly to you. This was a huge ward that was subdivided much the same way as these pillars subdivide. And on that side and back away from the nursing station, and on that side and back away from the nursing station, were medical patients. The variety had pneumonia, this kind of thing. Down the sides from the nursing station, because it seemed like the best thing to do, the psychiatric patients were housed. And this would include, anyone from a psychopath to a neurotic to a psychotic. And the kicker to all this is that in the middle was the intensive care unit for cardiac patients who were on monitors. And what I'm telling you is the truth. I think could be confirmed. Off to the left, by the way, was the renal unit, which was the only renal unit in Vietnam. And briefly, if you're in the renal unit, you're in there because you just can't make pee. And that's because you've got so many other injuries that your kidneys shut down, so they put you on a machine that drains all your blood out and filters it and cleans it out for you and then puts it back in. And I had a paranoid patient walking around in there. One night, I was told, after I left the ward, talking about people were drawing knives on him, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're in a state of paranoia and you're walking around seeing people that are having all their blood taken out of them, and you go for a further walk and you see people on cardiac monitors, it's pretty bad.
Okay. The last subject, because of our time again. This is not a war crime. It probably should be. It would happen in a war of 10 years. Okay, anybody, VD, what have we done to the Vietnamese people with venereal disease? Joe, you want to hit them with it, or you got the...
It's a strange subject to talk about.
Huh?
It's a strange subject to talk about, but my contribution would be the observations about our brigade's activities in the Dak Tho area when we used military personnel, military equipment, and military time to construct a large wooden framed restaurant, which was staffed by Vietnamese girls. I believe there were at any time from 12 to 14 who provided services for an entire brigade of about 4,500 men on a volunteer basis, alphabetically. The charge was approximately $2.50, and it also required a great deal of time and materiel and manpower from the medical company to examine these women several times a week. So it was more or less a command policy that prostitution be part of the military operation.
I can add to that that in the travels I had through the South, each and every one of the battalion areas of the 3rd Brigade of the 9th Infantry Division, located 40 miles south of Saigon, each had their own, under the Army sign for the PX, the post exchange, buildings that were erected for the purpose, supposedly, of a steam bath and massage. And each one of these things was, I talked to these medics. Some of these medics had a full-time chore to sit down there. That was his day's work, and to examine the GIs who wanted to partake of this particular service. I'm not so much against the service myself as I am the fact that these were Vietnamese people, and they were being used in this fashion. If you want to be a prostitute, I guess that's your own business, but... I'm not so sure that that was the case. I just don't know. I know that treatment for it, we were developing strains of gonococcal organisms that were so virulent that we're having a very difficult time eradicating them from people. Over here, I'm not too sure now what the normal dosage for, we didn't see much syphilis, that's not worth talking about, but I don't know what the treatment for an average strain of gonorrhea or gonococcus would be. I suspect it's in the realm of a million and two-tenths of penicillin. But the standing order over there was a combination of 4.8 million units of penicillin IM and something like 16 tablets of 250 milligram tetracycline per day for 3 or 4 days running, and then a continued dosage after that. And a lot of the times that this really didn't do the trick either. There were still people who were still having difficulty. And I think the long-range thing, when we're talking about what we do to Vietnam, with this thing coming up, when we leave, it stays.
And how about the treatment of the Vietnamese? Then, you know, can he get all these drugs to kill that organism?
No, it's not readily available to them. I you know, further earlier in this panel, I indicated to you that, you know, I stole the penicillin to treat a pneumonia.
At Da Nang, it was the same situation existed everywhere outside of a military installation. You had houses of prostitution.
WBAI New York.
Built by the military, or at least maintained by the 95th Evacuation Army Hospital at Da Nang. On the road leading to it were four houses, and the women who were the prostitutes who worked there received their treatment from sympathetic doctors and corpsmen that worked at the hospital, the evacuation hospital there. The Air Force, we had a very large number of Air Force personnel at our base, and we had a immunization clinic for the GIs, And the longest lines for any of the immunizations were the penicillin lines for VD. And if one of the Vietnamese women came in, whether she worked on the base or wherever she worked, claiming that she had caught VD, gonorrhea or whatever from a GI, she was always refused treatment on the grounds that if you treated one, you'd have to treat them all.
Are there any last comments that we have? Just 1 minute each. And
I have one that I'd like to make. That this isn't really a war crime, but Jeff can back me up on this because he was there and he saw the same thing. From the 95th Evacuation Hospital and from other hospitals in the area, when we received patients, they all funneled their patients into the 22nd Casualty Staging Flight where I worked to be medevaced either to another base in Vietnam, which is usually Cam Ranh Bay, or out of country to Japan or the Philippines or the States. We would receive our Korean and American and Australian and whatever other casualties besides Vietnamese were taken. Occasionally we'd get through, I shouldn't say occasionally, it was a regular thing, men who had been wounded and had not had their dressings changed in days. We would receive patients through who had had amputations of the legs or arms. And when we tried to change the dressings on these patients, we'd find that they were hard. It was an ACE wrap elastic bandage like you use in athletics. They were solid. And the only thing that had been done for them was to pour betadine, which is an antiseptic, over these wounds. After you soaked them and got them down, there were maggots inside. And these were our own men. And this is the medical treatment they received. And this isn't a thing that happened just once. It happened all the time. And
this was one hospital there, mainly.
Yeah, this was specifically from the 95th Evacuation Hospital. And those kind of things go on over there all the time. And
we had this one GI who came in who had this big gaping wound on the lower part of his leg. The dressings hadn't been changed in about 3 weeks. It was the same, I think it was the original battle dressing you had on there. Now why, I don't know, but it happens.
This is the superior medical care that we have.
Go ahead.
I was a recipient of some information today that made me think back, and I went home to get this because I think that this man who, for all good reasons, remains nameless, was shipped to us from the 91st Evacuation Hospital in July. I think that this man, as the story was given to us, this man was a recipient of some of our own misdirected fire. Whether he was or whether he wasn't, I don't believe really serves any purpose. But this man had so many diagnoses, and this is a photocopy or a transcript of the admission note when he came in. He had so many diagnoses that they ran out of space on this paper, and they put the rest on a second one. And I sort of keep it as a mute testimony of what not only these kind of weapons can do, but what can happen, and what I was part of. I've many times thought about throwing it away, but I never do, and I really don't know the reason for that. I suspect I do somewhere. But this man had a penetrating wound of all his extremities, face, chest, abdomen, genitals. He had a perforation of the small bowel, a contusion of the transverse colon, a laceration of the liver, a transection of his distal ureter on the right, a ruptured bladder, a wound open penetrating of the rectum, fracture of the pelvis, rupture of the right spermatic cord, rupture of his penis, fracture of some of the bones in his leg, contusions of his lower left lung lobe, a hemothorax, which is blood in the thorax, acute renal failure, and peritonitis. And the thing about it is that really struck home with me was he was admitted to our hospital on 22 June 1970. He was to go home 16 July 1970.
Thank you. We some of us have to make a plan, so we're going to have to go. I would like to just share with you one last comment during my 3 days here. I think all of us have been extremely frustrated by the lack of national press coverage. We came from... Excuse me. We came from many parts of the country, often at our own expense. And this isn't the only country where there's a blackout on news. We're not sure why. We feel what we had to say here was significant, and we all can prove we were in Vietnam. This is a Saigon newspaper, which I've saved. And this is an English language newspaper. It's quite obvious that they did not want us to get certain kinds of information. And in terms of the hearing that you've heard in the past 3 days, it's obvious that somebody does not want the American people to hear what we had to say here. Thank you.
A lot of people have made mention of the fact of alleged war crimes and alleged veterans and an alleged war in Southeast Asia. And I hope sincerely and devoutly that all of you here today will carry back what you heard from us and take it to your neighbors and your friends and tell the American people what is really going on in Southeast Asia.
That was the medical panel from the Winter Soldier investigation, which was taped in Detroit over the weekend of January 31st through February 2nd. That was the last panel, and with me in the studio are two of the participants in the Winter Soldier investigation, former Marine Sergeant Mike McCusker, who was with the Information Division, and Scott Camille of the 1st Marine Division, and in just a few moments we'll be talking to them. If you'd like to talk to them, we'll also be taking phone calls. Phone number is Oxford 78506. WBAI in New York City at 99.5 FM. With me in the studio are Sergeant Mike McCusker and Scott Camille. And if you'd like to talk to two of the veterans from the Winter Soldier investigation, you can call us now on Oxford 7-8506, and we'll take the first phone call now. WBAI, you're on the air. BAI, you're on the air.
Wait, let me turn my radio down.
Okay.
Good. Okay, I was very moved by what I heard both today and the weekend that I listened, and I'd like to know if there is going to be, first of all, I'd like to know if there's ever going to be transcripts available for people to buy so that, or in some form, so that it can actually be more publicized to the American people, because, you know, very few people know about this, and it's—I think a lot more people should.
I'm not sure exactly how we're going to disseminate the transcripts because we're running into a money problem.
Yeah, how much? That's what I mean. I wondered if how much it would cost to get one, because I know it's a lot of testimony.
I have absolutely no idea, because we haven't even begun to type up the transcripts yet.
Yeah.
And I know that all the veterans who participated are going to get transcripts so that they can use them within their own areas throughout the country.
Yeah.
And therefore, perhaps, like in each area, the vets themselves could perhaps get a fund up to start producing them locally and then selling them locally. I'm not sure yet.
Well, do you need? I was going to go over to 156 Fifth Avenue. And do they need help with things over there? I guess they would.
Oh yes.
Because I know that's where the organization is. Also, I want to know. Now, I guess in these transcripts, it would be everybody's name and rank and all of that stuff.
Yes, I was, if I can break in for a moment, I was just reminded we are putting out a book and trying to get that published.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I should have thought of that exact moment you asked the question.
Is that going to have a lot of this in it?
We're going to try and put as much of the testimony, if not all of the testimony.
Yeah, well, no, that's... I think you could probably get a publisher for that. I mean, someone. I know you probably get a lot of people that weren't willing, but you get some people that were willing to put it out. And also, do you know if there's going to be, I know McGovern and a couple other people talked about a congressional investigation. That might get it a little more publicized. I don't know. I haven't heard much indignation from Fulbright or a couple of the others whom I really think should have come out and said something, because I know usually when Fulbright says something, they publicize it a lot. But it's just, I just wonder why this hasn't happened, this congressional investigation that they were talking about.
There's a lot of speculation on that. You know, in the past, all the investigations that have taken place, where have they gone? What's ever happened to them?
Well, I don't know what's ever happened, but all I know is that when you have actual veterans that have been there testifying and the Americans know about it and hear what they have to say, I don't see how they could not pay attention or believe it, because most of the other things, that's what they did when they attacked people like Spock and people like that. They say, well, you weren't there, you didn't really know anything and things like that, or else you're a communist and so on. But they can't really say much when people like you get up and testify to things that really happened. That's the other question I wanted to ask you about. All of you personally, can you really get into trouble even though you're released and everything from the Army?
Oh, I don't believe so. Not really. It's up in the air. Some are still on inactive reserve.
Uh-huh.
Anytime you're involved in anything like this, you get visits paid for many different reasons. Some of our guys, I understand when they got back home in the Midwest, I think it was in Nebraska, got busted. Others were, for other things, of course.
Yeah, obviously.
And others were paid visits and asked about what happened.
I think congressional investigation, I mean, if people hear people saying that they've actually been in Vietnam, it's going to be very hard for them to argue it down and very hard for them to say, this isn't really so, it didn't really happen, even though they're going to want to. Because as I said, that's what they argue about when they talk about people like Spock and people like that. And they say, well, he doesn't really know, he hasn't really been there.
Well, if you've noticed what limited press coverage we got off of this, it was always alleged veterans, even though we had all our documents right in front of us. It was always alleged. They still tried to put the burden of proof upon us, even though we had the proof with us, but they refused to admit it. The press, you have to understand, is just about as responsible for this war as the administration is. For many factors, perhaps the main factor, if there's no malice intended, then a great sense of, let's call it racist ignorance.
Yeah.
Never covering the Vietnamese side of the coin. Absolutely refusing to know anything about Vietnam or its culture. Only taking what idiots like Bunker have to say about things. Listening to the generals or listening to the administration. They've absolutely done nothing on Vietnamese. They don't even know how to spell the names right.
The people that have tried a little, like Morley Safer, I think has had tried a little bit.
Yeah, and Safer was always in hot water. He was
right
there at the same time I was there.
People like that always seem to get into trouble for it.
Another point is, like, everyone's very interested in My Lai. Well, let's take a look from another vantage. Nobody has asked the question of the names of the people of My Lai. Who were those people, the people that died? And it seems like America is not worried about the crime for its victims. America's worried about the crime because of the principles.
Well, It's true, and also I think Nixon has done a very clever thing from his point of view in trying to eliminate the Americans on the ground, because he knows that South Vietnamese getting killed on the ground and things happening to them just wouldn't affect that Americans just don't give a damn. As long as it's American casualty figures go down, that they just won't care whatever happens. And he's always throwing that back, you know, there are no ground troops, and look at how the casualty figures are going down, and that really, a lot of people really don't care. I mean, Americans are more important people than Orientals anyway, and he's been able to be very effective, you know, this way, I think.
Okay, I think we're going to go on to another call, okay?
Okay, I'm sorry I took up too much time.
That's all right, thank you.
Thanks a lot.